You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today has just authored a new book, a fantastic book, about one of our presidents who has deep roots in our region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. Reading this really brought back a lot of memories of his administration, but also just the role our region plays in boosting great leaders. The book is called Reagan, The Life and Legend, obviously about former President Ronald Reagan, and the author is Max Boot, who's a historian and foreign policy analyst and writes regularly for The Washington Post. Max, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Well, pleasure to be on with you.
What led you to undertake a biography of Ronald Reagan? The timing is excellent in light of what's going on in our political, in our current politics, but what led you to Ronald Reagan?
Well, when I started this back in 2013, I obviously had no idea what was going to be going on in our politics. Never imagined that, you know, a real estate promoter named Donald Trump could possibly be president of the United States. So obviously the decision to write the book had nothing to do with current political trends. It really was motivated by my observation that Ronald Reagan was this incredibly important president, very consequential, really shaped America in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. And yet there was not a great biography of him out there. I mean, there are many books about Ronald Reagan, but nothing that was really a definitive treatment that provided a fair and balanced coverage of his life. And so that's what I set out to do, to provide an account that was neither a hagiography nor a hit job, but rather something that looked at him in full with both his strengths as well as his weaknesses, his achievements, as well as his failures. And I was very gratified to see the book review in the New Yorker, which said that Reagan, His Life and Legend, aims to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So that was kind of my mission accomplished moment.
And these are the types of biographies I like. And you were fair, I thought, objective. In you wrote, it doesn't just adore Reagan. It doesn't just criticize him. It takes a fair, objective look at him. Those are the best books. But let's talk about his upbringing. A lot of places here, Tampico, Galesburg, Monmouth, near where I live, Dixon, Illinois, over Eureka, where he went to college, Davenport, Iowa, where he started his career. What impact did this upbringing have in our region, have on his life and his career and terms as president?
Well, it obviously had a huge impact. And I begin the book by talking about the Midwest as a conception, which obviously is something that people only started talking about in the early 20th century, because that was, by that point, the U.S. stretched from sea to shining sea. And you could talk about this region as being the middle of the country. And it's always been, ever since, kind of associated with normality in America. I mean, whatever happens in the Midwest isn't usually identified as a regional phenomenon. This is kind of the essence of Americana right here. And Reagan very much embodied that. He was kind of a traditional, non-hyphenated, very mainstream kind of generic American raised in the Midwest. And, you know, even though his father was an Irish Catholic, and, you know, there was tremendous discrimination against Irish Catholics when he was growing up in the early 20th century, he didn't really identify with that so much. He identified with kind of generic white Protestant Americans. And that was kind of the ethos that he embodied. And so I think throughout his life, he sort of spoke for middle America and really had this connection with ordinary Americans, because he was really one of them as well. And as you know, came from very humble origins, with his father, Jack, being this alcoholic shoe salesman and the family having to move from town to town. I mean, that's why they lived in so many of these small towns in rural Illinois, is because his dad kept losing one job after another and kept seeing his dreams of opening a shoe emporium frustrated. So it was, you know, a very difficult, impoverished childhood, even though Reagan in later years would kind of put a rose-colored lens on everything. But, you know, his identity and his character was really forged in the cauldron of that difficult childhood in this small town America of the early, you know, 20th century, which is so vastly different from what the country is like today.
You know, we all know a lot about Reagan's life and career. I've read another biography of him, and there was a lot of new things in this book that you provide that I really found fascinating. One is the impact of his movie career on his life, and how he just seemed to always. It gives the impression he seemed to grasp for movies that he was aware of that had situations in his life. Where did that start from? And is that, how far did that go, I guess, to share with our listeners, this adaptation of movies to all aspects of his life?
Well, you know, movies have really shaped reality in America for more than 100 years, ever since the origins of Hollywood and the movie industry. And, you know, Ronald Reagan, like so many other youngsters across the country, was, you know, paying his nickel to go to the cinema in the 1920s and watch silent movies. And of course, it was a big deal when later in that decade, talkies came along with a jazz singer and other movies. And so, you know, I write about this some in the book, that movies really shaped America's image of themselves. It created this kind of mythologized world that, you know, people, you know, that influenced reality with, you know, with young Americans of the 20s and Reagan's generation modeling themselves after their heroes or heroines in the movies. And Reagan was certainly part of that. He loved Tom Mix and, you know, imagined himself as a cowboy in a white hat rescuing the damsel in distress, kind of playing out the movie scenarios. And then, of course, you know, he actually got to Hollywood, and probably enough, in the late 1930s, signed with Warner Brothers and actually became, first a B-movie actor, but then, you know, a movie star and making some A pictures as well. And obviously that had a huge influence on him. And sometimes in later life, he would kind of confuse scenarios from movies with what had actually happened. But he was really immersed in the world of movies. And even during World War II, you know, his primary interaction with what was going on was through the silver screen, because he was part of a motion picture unit for the U.S. Air Force in Culver City, California. And, you know, he was one of the first people to see movie images of the liberation of the concentration camps, movie footage that was rushed for processing back to the States. But then, you know, many years later in the 1980s, he was talking as if he'd actually seen the concentration camps himself. He hadn't, he had seen the movies, but that was really how he and so many other people at the time and really since, that's been their, you know, conception of reality. It's come from what they've seen on the screen.
The story's, you know, been told before, but he was brought up as a New Deal Democrat, worshipped Franklin Roosevelt, like my father, a lot of folks from that era. The position with GE is what really seems to change him politically. And this was after kind of his acting career started to dry up a little bit. That really was kind of a seminal moment in his thinking. What kind of led to that? Was it just the influence of like a big corporation paying him, or were there other aspects involved?
Well, Reagan, you know, when he talked about his political transformation from New Deal Democrat to right-wing Republican, he was not very helpful in what he said, because he often said, "I didn't desert my party. My party deserted me," to suggest that somehow the Democrats had veered far to the left, which wasn't the case at all. The Democrats were pretty mainstream and even conservative in the 1950s. It was really Reagan that had changed. And I traced the transformation in my book beginning during World War II, when he was still a pretty highly paid movie actor. And he really did not appreciate having to pay 90% of his income to the federal government. And then after the war, as his movie career was drawing up and he was getting more involved in union activism, became president of the Screen Actors Guild, he became caught up in these battles over communism in Hollywood. He testified before the House Un-American Affairs Committee. He was an FBI informant. He was integral to the operation of the blacklist in Hollywood. And he became convinced that there was a made in Moscow plot to take over the movie industry, which I think, based on my reading of the evidence, is vastly exaggerated. But he sincerely believed it, in part because he was imbibing the paranoia of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. But then the transformation was really completed, as you suggested, in the 1950s, when he was host of General Electric Theater on CBS. And also a spokesman for GE, which in those days was a very right-wing company. GE executives thought that promulgating free market views would be an inoculation against labor union troubles. And so Reagan was a very dutiful employee. He read all this literature that GE, foisted off on its employees, and he believed it. And he started expressing some of those same themes in his own speeches, which he was giving on behalf of the company. And so by the early 1960s, this one-time New Deal Democrat who had voted for FDR four times had become this ardent Republican who was warning that John F. Kennedy was taking America towards Marxism, which sounded, pretty extreme and kooky at the time, but that's how far to the right he moved.
One aspect of this that I could relate to, and I thought was really fascinating in the big picture part of the story. I mean, Reagan is, his detractors criticized him, called him kind of a dunce, didn't have much respect for his intellectual abilities. But I was fascinated to read in your book how I didn't realize he was afraid to fly early in his life. I share that. I mean, I get on a plane, but it scares me to death. And he would take trains. Well, that's long trips, and he would take his time by reading a lot. Could you kind of expound on that a little bit, which I thought was really interesting?
Yeah, I mean, he had a couple of scary rides in airplanes in the 1940s, and so got scared of flying, which in those days was, probably made some sense because flying was much more dangerous then than it is today. And so he would, on these long trips for GE, where he was constantly on the road for him, he would take the train from LA to Chicago to New York. And so that was a multi-day trip, and he had a lot of time to read and reflect. And so it was on these train rides that he was, reading National Review and Human Events and, Friedrich Hayek and Whitaker Chambers and all these other conservative writers and thinkers. And that's when he was really being converted to a complete conservative in the 1950s.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Max Boot, who's the author of a brand new book called Reagan, His Life and a Legend. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. A lot of local angles on this. And as Max said, it's a fair biography. It's an objective biography. It's not one way or the other. It tells a very straightforward story of Ronald Reagan, which I appreciated. I like to read this type of history that's not slanted. There's a lot of myths about Ronald Reagan, and I think you do a really good job of kind of exploring those fairly on both sides. When you went into this, you were like a lot of us, we've got our views on Reagan, but what did you see as maybe the biggest misconception of him?
I think the biggest misconception is that he was ideological rather than pragmatic, and what I found was he was both. I mean, he could be very ideological on the campaign trail, but once in office, he was actually pretty pragmatic. And I think he surprised a lot of people because, again, the views that he was espousing by the early 1960s in some ways made him sound like a right-wing kook. He was claiming the Democrats were going to turn America communist, that, social welfare legislation like Medicare and Medicaid was going to lead to the extinction of freedom in America. He sounded pretty extreme, but he didn't act extreme once he was elected governor of California in 1966 and then president in 1980, because in both jobs, he showed that he was very much willing to cut deals with Democrats. Sure, he cut taxes sometimes, but he also raised taxes. As governor of California, he signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country and a very tough gun control bill. He constantly castigated the hippies and radicals and beatniks at the colleges, but at the same time, he raised spending for higher education by 136%. Then as president of the United States, he again did deals with Democrats in Washington. He signed legislation that legalized millions of undocumented immigrants. And in his second term in office, he worked closely with Mikhail Gorbachev, the world's number one communist, to peacefully wind down the Cold War, which is the last thing you would have expected from somebody like Reagan, who had been such a hardline anti-communist throughout his political career. And yet he understood that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist leader, somebody he could do business with, and they established a close relationship. And I think that's an indication of how extremely pragmatic he actually turned out to be in office, very different from the expectations of both a lot of his supporters and a lot of his critics.
I teach part-time, and I was telling my students some of the stories about Reagan and Tip O'Neill getting together with a bottle of whiskey and working these issues out. Is that true, especially as it regards immigration? I mean, students now are really amazed that the parties actually used to compromise.
Yeah, it was a different era. You know, it seems like a lost golden age of American politics where, you know, Democrats controlled the House every year that Reagan was president. So if he was going to get anything done, he had to do deals with Democrats. And he did want to get things done because, as he often said, he had nothing but contempt for conservatives who want to go over the cliff with their flags flying. That was a term he often used. He said, you know, I'd rather get 80% of what I want today and come back for more tomorrow than insist on 100% and get nothing. So he believed in compromise, and he certainly compromised with Tip O'Neill. I mean, I think there's some mythology there because, you know, Tip and Reagan were not great friends, although they could certainly swap Irish stories and banter with each other. But, you know, Tip O'Neill in particular could be very hard on Reagan, often accused them of forgetting where he came from and, you know, neglecting the poor people of America and you know, being a terrible president. And you know, they had sharp differences on ideology, but they were both very practical politicians. They could count votes, and they both felt like they were in Washington to accomplish things, not just to make futile gestures.
The really interesting part, and I, you know, there have been forests of trees cut down, written books on leadership style. Reagan had a very interesting leadership style and was very detached, I think is the word you use. Just really, he allowed his aides really to do a lot, I think more than maybe what we were aware at the time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the way I put it in the book is that Reagan was a great leader, but he was a poor manager, and he inspired the nation, but he didn't really get into the nitty-gritty of governance very much. And so he really needed subordinates who knew what they were doing. And he had that quite often. And when he had it, he was successful. He certainly had it in his first term with Jim Baker as White House Chief of Staff. And Baker was one of the most effective political players Washington has ever seen. And so he did very well. His second term got off to a very rocky start because Jim Baker decided to switch jobs with Don Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary. And they kind of casually presented it to Reagan in a half an hour Oval Office meeting, and Reagan signed off on it without thinking too much about it. But that turned out to be disastrous because Don Regan just did not have Jim Baker's political instincts. And the result was the Iran-Contra affair and a bunch of other messes. So Reagan, you know, really, I think, I mean, all presidents need effective aides, but I think Reagan more than most really relied on effective helpers. And, you know, if he didn't have it, he was in big trouble.
He really pushed, though, for certain things that he believed in. And I think one of those was this relationship with the Soviet Union and Gorbachev. What a huge change in how he worked. Who would have thought that he would be the one talking about eliminating, cutting nuclear weapons with the Soviet leader? Was this related to the assassination attempt? I want to focus on that for a minute, because usually, you know, it's well known that Reagan didn't attend church, but you point out that he was very religious. And did the assassination attempt contribute a lot to that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. He barely survived being shot by John Hinckley in early 1981. And, you know, as he convalesced, he wrote in his diary saying that he thought that this was a message from the Almighty, that he was saved for a higher purpose. And that purpose was to save the world from nuclear Armageddon. And that was a concept that he often cited, Armageddon. And in fact, so much so that his aide Mike Deaver told him to stop telling visitors to the Oval Office about Armageddon because he was frightening people. But for him, this was a very real fear. And, you know, he certainly pursued some hardline policies against the Soviet Union, which he called the evil empire, and he raised defense spending and so on and so forth. But he also wanted to reach out to the Soviet leadership and to work with them to reduce the risk of nuclear annihilation. And he was very frustrated in his first term because, as he said, you know, the Soviet leaders kept dying on me. They were these, you know, elderly apparatchiks in the Kremlin. And it was finally, he was able to find somebody to work with and meet with when Gorbachev, who was younger and who was very reform-minded, came along in 1985 and became the Soviet leader and launched this reform agenda known as Glasnost and Perestroika. And Reagan did not initiate the Gorbachev reforms, but he certainly supported them and understood and created a very positive working relationship with Gorbachev, even though a lot of hardliners, including his own defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, were telling him he couldn't trust Gorbachev and he was just, you know, another communist trying to pull the wool over our eyes. But Reagan didn't believe that because he met Gorbachev in Geneva in 1985 and established a personal rapport that I think helped to change history.
Did the increased defense spending, specifically on the Strategic Defense Initiative called Star Wars, did that contribute to the fall of the Soviet Union?
I don't think it did. I think that's a myth because what really contributed to the fall of the Soviet Union was Gorbachev's reforms. And I mean, he wasn't intending to collapse the Soviet Union, but that was the impact of his reforms. And, you know, his reforms were, he didn't initiate those reforms because he wanted to compete with the U.S. in the arms race. Gorbachev wanted to end the arms race, which he thought was wasteful and dangerous. So, no, I don't think that Reagan's defense buildup in the first term contributed to the end of the Cold War. In fact, it contributed, it ratcheted up tensions. And there, in 1983, there was a series of war scares, which scared Ronald Reagan, among other people. And he tried to pull back and realize that the Cold War was reaching a very dangerous impasse. And I think it was, so I think Reagan deserves a lot of credit for the end of the Cold War, but it's not for what a lot of his fans want to give him credit for. It was really, I think, his conciliatory policies in his second term, much more than his confrontational policies in the first term that allowed the Cold War to end and the Soviet Union to collapse.
You did a great job in that book describing that era and at least one occasion when nuclear war seemed a little closer than we would all be comfortable knowing about, which was kind of scary to read. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a series of war scares in 1983, and the closest call may have been when this Russian warning center flashed up on the screen information that a U.S. Nuclear missile launch was underway. And so the Russian duty officer had about 30 minutes to figure out, was this real or not? And if it was real, the Soviet Union was going to launch their nuclear missiles at us, and the result would be World War III and hundreds of millions of people dead. And that catastrophe was only avoided because of the actions of this unknown hero, Colonel Petrov, who was the Russian duty officer. And instead of telling his superiors, the Americans are launching their weapons, we have to launch ours, instead he took time to confirm whether a launch was actually underway and finally figured out this was a technical glitch. But that was a technical glitch that could have resulted in unimaginable catastrophe.
Just absolutely chilling. You can't really talk about Ronald Reagan, I don't think, without talking about the role of his wife, Nancy. I was surprised to see her ideologically, she wasn't. I always thought maybe she was a little matched Reagan's more conservatism, but that really wasn't the case.
It really wasn't. And just talking to their kids and others who knew her, they all basically said she didn't have much ideology. Her only real belief was she wanted to support her husband. She wanted Ronnie to be a success. And I think she did play an important role in doing that, in part because her personality was so different from her husband's. Because, you know, Ronald Reagan was very genial, very trusting, almost naive, really, because he kind of assumed everybody was well-intentioned and everything would work out well. But Nancy Reagan was very different. She was kind of a worrywart. She was jittery. She sort of assumed that people were out to screw them unless proven otherwise. And so, you know, one of Reagan's aides described Nancy Reagan as kind of the HR department of Reagan Inc. She was the person who often hired and fired on his behalf. And that's critically important because, you know, every successful politician needs that kind of enforcer. And Ronald Reagan himself was too nice a guy to play that role. But Nancy Reagan certainly stepped up and, you know, was integral to his rise. I mean, I had aides who told me that, you know, Ronald Reagan would have never been elected governor or president if it hadn't been for Nancy Reagan.
Interesting. I found one of the characters in this book who I knew, I was aware of his role a little bit, but in your book, you reference him quite a bit, and that's Stuart Spencer. He seems like he had a pretty key role throughout Reagan's political career in kind of guiding him, not only in campaigns, but in other key moments. Can you describe him and what he did and his role?
Yeah, Stu Spencer was Reagan's original political consultant dating back to 1966. He was kind of one of the pioneers in political consulting and really a legend in the business. He was really the mastermind of every single winning campaign that Reagan ran. And the one time when Stu Spencer was working against Reagan, not for him, was in 1976 when he was working for Ford. And guess what? That's a race that Reagan lost. So Stu was very close to Reagan, much more so than a lot of people have written books about it. But he's never really written or spoken that much about it. But I found him to be one of the most invaluable sources of information because, A, as I said, he was very close to Reagan, but he's also not a conservative ideologue. He's kind of this no BS cynical political consultant who kind of calls it as he sees it. So he could, you know, talk about Reagan's weaknesses as well as his strengths. He wasn't, you know, he didn't worship the guy. He respected him, but he didn't worship him. And so he had a, you know, a fascinating perspective on Reagan's rise that I think few others had.
And he could be very blunt in talking to him too, which few others did.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very blunt. I mean, I asked him about this infamous episode in 1980 where Reagan went to the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi near the site where three civil rights workers had been slain. And Reagan endorsed states' rights, which, you know, in the South in those days, that was kind of a code word for opposing civil rights. And so I asked Stu, I said, Stu, did Reagan know what he meant, what he was saying when he said states' rights? And, you know, Stu's, you know, a lot of other Republicans, Trent Lott and others said, oh, he was just talking about federalism and he was a former governor and that's all he cared about. But, you know, Stu kind of cut through the BS and said, you know, we never talked about it, but Reagan wasn't stupid. He knew what he was saying.
I'll have you wrap up here, Max. Just what is the legacy of Reagan? I mean, a lot of historians, you know, rank presidents and have him in the top 10 or all. What, how could you kind of wrap up his legacy, I guess, to our country?
Well, there was a poll of presidential historians a few years ago that placed him number 9. So, you know, not in Mount Rushmore territory, but kind of the next level of near great. And I think that's pretty fair, despite all, there are a lot of failures of his presidency. He didn't confront the AIDS pandemic. He had the Iran-Contra scandal. A lot of things went wrong, but I think two big things went right for which he deserves a lot of credit. The first of which was he really helped the nation to recover from the malaise of the 1970s, the decade of Watergate and Vietnam and the Iran hostage crisis, stagflation, gasoline lines. We were at a pretty low point in 1981 when Reagan took over, and he had this kind of boundless optimism and good cheer and charisma. And, you know, he helped the nation to recover its confidence in itself so that by 1984, he was able to run on a slogan of "It's morning again in America," and people believed it. And you know, he won in a 49-state landslide, which seems unbelievable today, but it really happened. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for that in his first term. And his second term, as we were discussing, I think he deserves a lot of credit for working with Gorbachev to peacefully end the Cold War, a conflict that could have resulted in nuclear annihilation. So I think those are his two big historic achievements. And that's why he's still ranked pretty high by historians.
One final real quick question. Could Reagan be elected in today's Republican Party?
Wow, it would be tough. I mean, he is so different from today's Republicans. He was somebody who was pro-free trade, pro-immigration, pro-NATO, pro-standing up to Russia. And, you know, he had a very positive, sunny, optimistic vision of America as a shining city on a hill. And he just did not engage in kind of the ruthless, cutthroat politics of today with all the invective and name-calling. I mean, he would never, you know, say a derogatory thing about his political adversaries. He was a real gentleman. And I suspect if you were around today, he would probably be denounced by a lot of Republicans as a rhino, as a Republican in name only.
Max Boot has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of a brand new book called Reagan, His Life and Legend. Excellent book. A lot of local references here. And I think our listeners will love it. Max, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Really appreciate it. Good conversation. Thank you.